You're listening to episode 82 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get started, I wanted to thank Sunbasket for sponsoring today's episode. I'm so proud to collaborate with a meal kit delivery service that focuses on offering organic, healthy, and delicious recipes and ingredients straight to your door. Check out sunbasket.com/88cups to check out the special offer they have for our Storyteller Tribe, and hang around at the end of the show to find out more about Sunbasket. Did you know that our private Facebook group is an awesome safe space to be a part of? It's the perfect place for you to hang out if you're looking for an intimate community to hang out with other writers and check in on your work in progress. We also post threads where you can submit your listener questions for upcoming interviews with really cool guests. I know there's a lot of you craft-focused writers out there listening, so if that's you, there's amazing questions and resources passed around in our group, and there's even more love, support, and encouragement going on in there. And by the way, we just recently decided that we'll be mixing in some live Facebook videos that's exclusive only for our members in our private Facebook group. So be sure to come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I'm so excited to meet you in there. Now on to our show. Cami Garcia is a number one New York Times bestselling and Bram Stoker nominated author and the co-author of the Beautiful Creatures and Dangerous Creatures novels. Her solo series, The Legion, includes the instant New York Times bestseller Unbreakable and its sequel Unmarked. In today's episode, we learn what drew Cami to write in the young adult and romance genre and the inspiration behind her novel, The Lovely Reckless. We discuss the inner workings of writing for a fandom and all about Cami's experience writing the X-Files Origins book. We also discuss Cami's work as a teacher for 17 years and uncover the inequalities in the public school system, and I'm really looking forward to you hearing Cami's advice that will help create change. She also talks about why we are responsible for speaking up and stepping in to help one another, and how the young adult community's support of diversity creates new normals. We also touch on the underlying theme of fitting in and embracing your differences throughout all of her novels. For our craft-focused writers, Cami walks us through writing POV characters with authenticity and why it's crucial to understand your character's past when you're crafting dynamic villains in your story. Cami shares powerful advice on creating solid query letters and how to effectively pitch your books to literary agents. Now let's jump right in.
Cami?
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm so good. You sound like you're in a studio.
No, I'm in my room, actually.
Oh my gosh. Well, it works out.
I kicked everyone out. So
thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Well, my dogs are very noisy if anyone comes to the door, so I had to send them downstairs.
What kind of dogs do you have?
I have a miniature long-haired dachshund.
Oh.
I know. But they're hounds, so they actually howl. It's so annoying. And then I have half Shiba Inu, half cattle dog, so he looks kind of like a coyote.
That is so cool. I've never heard of that mix.
Well, the weird thing is I hadn't either. He's the best dog ever. And I was thinking that I might end up getting another one. And I was looking up rescues. And when I looked at the rescues, there were a lot of dogs that looked like him.
Oh my God, he sounds freaking cute. That's all I know. He just sounds cute.
If you go on my Instagram, their names are Spike and Oz after characters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Nice.
If you go on my Instagram, there are lots of photos of them reading. They get way more likes than my photos do, that's for sure.
I feel like all animals always do.
I follow this crazy raccoon that someone raised that thinks it's a dog.
Yes, Pumpkin. Hello, he's famous.
Yeah, Pumpkin.
Do you follow cats as well or no?
The only cat I follow is Grumpy Cat because he and I have a similar personality.
Okay, I don't mean to show off. I carried Grumpy Cat at South by Southwest. They had a meet and greet, and Grumpy Cat is a girl. I had no idea until I carried her. I was like, oh, he's so cute. And her owner was like, actually, she. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Did you get your picture taken with her?
Yes. And of course, my face is all distorted looking, but Grumpy Cat is looking awesome. I just wish the photo wasn't taken in the dark. It was in a dark room so that Grumpy Cat wasn't, I think she was feeling quite overwhelmed.
I wouldn't mind if put the cat in a bed or something and people want to stand next to it and take a picture.
I wouldn't want to be picked up and carried around like that.
I don't think I would want someone picking me up and carrying me around either.
Exactly.
And if I had a cat or a pet that was that valuable, I would definitely not let random people.
Oh, hell no. She's so small. Well, I love that we just had a chat about animals.
I could literally sit on Instagram and look at all those animals.
Me too. I look at everything. I used to follow rabbits. And actually, there were a few animals I followed. A Colonel Meow. He's such a funny looking, angry cat. But he passed away. And then this rabbit I followed passed away. I was distraught. And I was really upset. And I realized I'm getting really attached to them. I can't keep following them.
I know. If Grumpy Cat dies, I'm going to be really unhappy. Well, my daughter is really obsessed with Pusheen. And the real Pusheen is not alive anymore.
I thought Pusheen was just a cartoon.
Pusheen, the animated cat, is based on a real cat in Ireland that looks exactly like that, that was crazy overweight. And Pusheen means kitty in Irish. And if you Google it, you can see a picture of her, but she died. So the real Pusheen is not actually alive.
This whole time, I thought it was just a Japanese-inspired cartoon of an adorable
cat.
So
did I. My daughter has a book about Pusheen, and she was like, Pusheen is not Japanese. Everything my daughter owns has to be ordered from Japan.
I know.
She doesn't like anything American. So I was like, that cat's definitely Japanese. No, she is Irish. It's a specific kind of cat that looks like that. It's from Ireland. And she died, but I don't know how. Somehow, I don't know if it's because of like social media or whatever. It's actually an American company. I think it's Gunn. Someone bought the rights to make the t-shirts and the stuffed animals and everything.
And it's all over Facebook, too. It's one of the official stickers that you can use to send in Facebook messengers.
Someone owns the rights to distribute the merchandise. Not like Grumpy Cat, though, where everything really is based on seeing real photos of Grumpy Cat. This cat really was real, but I think everyone just assumed she was a cartoon because you never saw the real cat.
I had no idea until you're telling me right now.
If you have a 9-year-old daughter, you would know everything.
You know way more than we should.
I'll start telling somebody about something and she'll be like, no. No, Mom, Pusheen is not from Japan. And I'll be like, okay. She looks like she's from Japan. She looks like a kawaii character.
How do you know about kawaii characters?
You're kidding me, right? My daughter was Ryakuma for Halloween.
Adopt me into your family, please.
You've literally not met my family every year at Comic-Con.
You guys go to Comic-Con every year?
My husband made video games. I have been going to Comic-Con since before I was a writer. And I did not used to cosplay, but then when my kids got to a certain age, my husband won't do it. He wears like a Boba Fett sweatshirt. They wanted me to get involved. I kind of half-assed it. Last year, my daughter... Well, she usually has two costumes that she'll like alternate between. Have you ever seen those big kawaii, those zip-up things that have a hood?
Are we talking about the onesies?
Yes.
Yes, I love those.
She has a Ryakuma one. She's very popular with the publishing industry. Everyone knows her.
Why is she so awesome?
My son was Star Wars bound. Literally, until Shopkins, every toy I bought, I would pay more to ship the stuff from eBay from Japan than the actual toys. Do you go to Comic-Con?
I have not. That's why I'm saying you're freaking cool. You would think I have, but I actually haven't gone. But I've gone to one that was kind of similar in LA. I had one of my best friends who was on a TV show with aliens. So I kind of got a feel of it, but I heard that it's like a small little taste of what Comic-Con is about.
Yeah, and you should go to Comic-Con. It's cool.
I think I was in San Diego at the time that they did have Comic-Con, but I was at a beer festival instead with my girlfriend. We were doing some research there and just checking it out. So I totally missed Comic-Con, but I bumped into a lot of the people who were at Comic-Con and it was really fascinating and they're all really nice.
You'd be surprised. There's actually a lot of people who bring their kids.
Oh my gosh, I need to go with my sisters. I feel like they would have fun with me.
It was so cute. You could turn yourself into a Powerpuff Girl.
I want to be Bubbles.
It was really cute.
I would really love for listeners to learn more about you and how you got to where you got. You sound like a New Yorker. You don't live in New York. You're in Maryland?
Yeah, I'm originally from the DC area. And then I moved to LA to teach. I was a teacher. I stayed out there for a long time and I got married. And then I moved back here. And now I live in Maryland, 40 minutes from DC. So it's like I'm close enough, but I'm not in the middle of everyone's traffic. Because when you work at home, I don't need to run around. As long as it's a nice place for my kids to go to school, and I don't really need to be in the city. In LA, even though I was on Sawtelle, West LA is still the city. I'm happy to be in the forest.
We need to take you camping more often.
No. The house in the forest. No camping.
Like, I don't even do glamping, all right? We need a full-on house.
Glamping to me is there's a full hotel that's in the woods, not like a log cabin that bugs can get get in. That's so gross.
I freaking love camping, which is why I find this so funny.
But I bet you did not have to go with your parents all the time as a kid.
I wish I did. I only went once as a child.
I went as a kid all the time, and now I hate camping.
What? I would think that you would like it.
No, we got eaten by bugs. It was terrible. So camping is not my jam. I like to stay at hotels. There's nothing outdoorsy about me. Me and the outdoors don't mix. That's why I like cities where I can just wander around and there's food and streets. I like where I live because it's pretty to look outside, but I don't like go running around in nature very often. My kids do, but I don't.
Does your husband like nature or he's on the same boat?
He's not super outdoorsy, but he does stuff. My son likes to go on ropes courses and stuff, and he does that with him. And he likes to go boating. And he was an athlete, so he's more outdoorsy than me. He's like me. Like, he does not like to go out in the summer when it's like super humid on the East Coast. Skis. He definitely likes to be outdoors, but he's not like one of those people who goes hiking every weekend. My friend Marie Lou and her husband Primo go hiking all the time, and it's like, we never go.
Oh my God. Wait, you're friends with Marie Lou, the amazing writer.
I blurred Marie's first book. I found it myself, actually. My assistant came back from BEA because I didn't go, and she brought me the book. Got some books for free while she was there, but she wanted to read. And she read it on the plane, and she said, you will love this book. You should read it. And I read it. And Marie followed me on Twitter. I messaged her and I asked her if I could get her editor's email because I loved her book. And she wrote me back and said, who is this?
Oh my God.
No one knew who she was yet. And she was like, who is this? And I was like, it's Cami Garcia. And she's like, no, who is it really? And I said, I'm going to give you my email and you email me and I'll email you back from my website email. And she was really embarrassed.
We had Marie on the show and she's absolutely awesome. I love her. Felt like we were old friends. I was like, okay, as soon as we're back in LA, we got to go eating with her dude because he seems to be all about food.
Primo knows where to eat.
That's what we were connecting over because me and my girlfriend, and I, no joke, ever since I started dating her, and she's kind of angry that I'm blaming her, but she's always cooking for her menu and stuff like that and experimenting. So I gained about 15 pounds in the last year and I'm still trying to work on that. And she's like, no, it's since you're podcasting because you don't move anymore. I'm just like, it's your food. It's not my fault you can cook so well. Yeah, we are absolutely. Yeah.
If someone's cooking for you, you definitely are going to be eating more if they're a good cook.
Yes. Oh my God, I freaking love What a Small World this is.
I co-founded Y'all Fest with Margie, and then Marie's on the board for Y'all West. That was only a couple of years ago. I met her because I blurbed the book. And then when I was at Comic-Con, Marie used to do art for video games, and my husband made video games. So they knew a bunch of his people. So then after I blurbed her book, when it was an arc before it came out, we were at Comic-Con and she had messaged me and said, do you want to meet up? I would love to say hi. And then we met up and walked around and stuff. And that's how we kind of became friends. And it was like the year her book came out. It was so long ago.
I thought the Hollywood world was a small world. Entering into this publishing world, I'm like, everyone literally knows everybody.
Especially in YA and children's. I don't know anybody in adult, but I wrote romance. I know tons of romance authors and I know tons of YA authors. I think it's even smaller than Hollywood. Young adult publishing, the number of editors and the imprints that do that and romance, they're very specific. Versus adult, there's so many adult writers.
You being so familiar with both of these worlds, do you have one world that you like a little bit more biased towards?
I think for me, even though all of my books have romance, and that is a key component. The Lovely Reckless, which I just put out, was the first book I'd ever written where the romance was really the focal point. Usually the romance is woven into the plot, which is suspenseful and has a lot. I mean, they all have romance, but I felt like that was a romance. I adore the romance community because they are so incredibly welcoming. I run the programming for the YA track of the RT Book Lovers Convention.
That's awesome.
So I've met a lot of them, but I think it's hard because at the end of the day, I think even if I bumped up the age a little bit to like college, I really feel like YA is really the core of what I do because that age somewhere, most of my characters aren't younger than 15. Most of them are like 16 to 18. I feel like the, you know, that age of like 15 to 20, those tend to be the stories that I gravitate toward. So I feel like even if I write a romance, the character will most likely be still in that age range.
Gotcha. Yep. That makes sense.
I mean, I taught 17 years. There's a reason I didn't work with adults. I mean, now I have a job where I work with other adults that are like me who don't want to hang out with real adults. Kids and teens are the people that I'm comfortable with. Writing for them is how I got started.
What I like to write, I gravitate towards what really haunts me. Memories or chapters of my life that I'm obsessed with and I just got to go back over and over again. For you, did something happen in your teen ages, like teen years, where you feel really pulled towards writing for that specific age group?
I was very small but fierce. I have four brothers, stepbrothers included. My stepdad was an undercover cop in DC.
What?
Yeah, and that's actually where The Lovely Reckless came in, because in The Lovely Reckless, it's about a girl who comes from a really affluent, you know, her mom's really wealthy and she lives in this part of DC that's very wealthy, and her boyfriend gets killed and she goes into like a spiral. She suffers from PTSD and, you know, she just kind of becomes really reckless. Her mom feels like she can't help her. And when she gets kicked out of private school, she sends her to live with her dad, who is an undercover cop in stolen cars, which is exactly what my stepdad did. It was a way for me to use a lot of those stories and experiences without writing like a memoir, because I don't think I could write a character very well if the character was me. I need the character to be able to be their own person. So I have that separation to do the story justice. So even though a lot of the characters in there are inspired by people, and even though Frankie, the main character, has things in common with me, she isn't me. But a lot of the situations she was in are situations that I was in. And that's why I switched to contemporary, because I kind of had all the pieces for that story for a really long time, but I didn't know how to put them all together. I just felt like I write fantasy and suspense and horror and I don't write contemporary. Eventually, Margie, my writing partner for Beautiful Creatures, and Holly Black, who's a friend of mine, kept pushing me and I decided to do it. Again, it was really because I feel like there's a lot of stories that you can tell. For me, I was more the person who stuck up for people who were being bullied. I have a really weird reaction to bullying. I had friends who were bullied. People tried to bully me because I was really small. I was short. I was very short until I went to college. I was really dangerous. So like they would only bully me for 15 seconds and then it would be over. I took martial arts. Like no one really
wants to. That's so badass.
Well, I was a boy basically and with long hair. But I saw other people getting bullied and it always bothered me. The whole idea of picking on someone weaker than you, either smaller or younger, or who doesn't know how to stick up for themselves. To me, that's the ultimate cowardice. If anything, I wrote about it in the BNN Teen blog. I constantly was sticking up for people who were bullied. But again, it wasn't like I was Miss Popular. I was different and fringe. I feel like because I still had friends and because I could stick up for myself, it prevented me from being really an outlier, where I was totally on my own and had to forge my own path. I still fit in with enough people that I was never on my own. But I felt I was on my own. Even though I had friends, I felt really isolated.
Yeah,
I have ADD. I suffer from anxiety and depression, but I didn't know that when I was younger. So I internalized a lot of things, especially with the anxiety. You know, you turn on yourself. It's like you are criticizing yourself and you have this voice that won't shut up. It's interesting. You always feel like as a teen that whatever is going on with you is you're the weirdo and it's no one else experiences that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't something that I was going to tell people feel really bad about myself, because number one, everyone really felt bad about themselves. What was there to do about it? One of the things that helped me is making sure that other people didn't feel like that. And I feel like in a way, exercised the demon for a little while.
Yeah.
Because I felt if I'm helping someone else, then I wasn't a bad person or I wasn't lame as I thought I was. At least I was doing something good. I didn't do it like necessarily for that high or whatever. And back then I didn't know why I did it. But literally my friends would be like, it's like you have a death wish. If there's a stranger who is getting mugged, you get involved. Part of that is once I became friends with other kids and I realized all the stuff I knew because of my stepdad's job that the average person didn't know. That when you see somebody who is in a situation that's potentially dangerous and they don't know it, I feel like you have a responsibility. It's like if you know there's a ledge and someone's about to step off and you don't say anything. I've been in situations where I've been in bars. I was in college, you know, like girls drinking too much. And like I can see the guys, the predators. And I've literally just been, you need to come to the bathroom, walked people out. I have a sixth sense about that kind of thing. But it also, I definitely am not one of those people who thinks that the world is really all good. I believe there's plenty of bad.
I love that you do that because I feel like that's almost like a social responsibility too. And came across this article where two girls saw one guy slip a date rape pill into drink.
Right.
And they were trying to signal to her without being obvious in front of the date. They couldn't get a hold of her, but they waited for her to go to the bathroom. Then they followed her to the bathroom to tell her. And I feel like that's such an important thing to just be aware of. And I feel for other fellow women to know there is something that can be done in those circumstances, that you don't have to just stand back and don't be afraid.
I would have called the police and waited to set him up. That would have been what I would have done. I would have gotten him arrested.
Do you feel growing up with your dad being in his field, so no matter what, there were always moments that you felt like you had to step in? There was never one time where you felt, oh, I don't want to step in, and you were kind of having like an internal conflict?
Especially now that I have kids and I feel I can't be as reckless. I was in a movie theater once with my sister, who's much younger than me. She's my half sister and she's 19 years younger than me.
Oh, wow.
And it was Aladdin or some kids movie in the middle of the day. I got up to take her to the bathroom and I was walking down the aisle and I turned and there was a guy all by himself in the back row doing something questionable. And that was a situation where, as someone who is a cop's kid, you don't want to finger, especially a child predator, and let them see a child that's with you. It's very dangerous. But I also was not going to let him walk out of that movie theater and not get arrested and wandering around Century City. To their credit, I remember I told the movie theater security and they immediately called the police and they came and they were waiting by the theater in case he tried to come out. There was these kids making the popcorn and stuff in the back. And I told them, the cops, that I would only stay and ID him if they let my sister go around in the back. It was a girl who was 22 or something, and you could tell she was like a babysitter, and she worked at the theater. There was a little space, and she was eating popcorn with her and hanging out. As I said, like, I don't want him to see my sister. That's what I did. So I feel like there are times where you have to do that, or you have to call the police, and maybe you're just following the car and you to make sure, or the girl to make sure they don't leave. That's just as powerful, because what's most important is to do something to make sure, even though those girls waited, the fact that they waited and they didn't leave and they waited till she went to the bathroom so they could tell her, that's what you do.
It's the most dangerous when you're a bystander.
Yeah. If you don't feel safe to insert yourself into the situation, then you call 911, you tell someone to get help, you stick around so that person, and, you know, drags his girlfriend away by the hair, you know where he goes. And it's the same with teens. Alex London and Meg Medina started the petition with a whole bunch of children and YA authors when North Carolina passed their bathroom law. We all boycotted. We won't do events there until they change it. It's interesting because even that, I feel you don't have to do something physical. Sometimes that situation, to me, Margie has a queer daughter. She's genderqueer, like she's undecided. So she definitely deals with that bathroom situation. A kid who's 14 years old, the idea that someone would feel it was appropriate to let a child be in a situation that's that fraught with violence. Trans kids and adults are the most victimized group in the country. That kind of thing, I feel Alex London couldn't walk everyone to the bathroom and Meg couldn't walk everyone to the bathroom, but they figured out a way to step in and help anyways.
You gotta find ways.
There's ways. When Trump was elected and started talking about the anti-Muslim ban and everything, Saba Tahir was a keynote at Y'all Fest, and she was saying, all of us, our responsibility, if we're not Muslim or Islamic, or we're not from whichever group he's decided to target at the moment, is to be looking out for those people who are.
Yes, yes.
I heard when he was stirring all that anti-Muslim rhetoric, someone tried to pull a woman's headscarf. She was in her early 20s, a girl's headscarf. Off on the subway, and these other people on the subway got involved. Don't touch her. You know, she asserted herself too. But I feel the fact that other people
stepped
stood up. Right. The fact that there's like five people saying, get the hell away from her, instead of just her and everyone watching, made a difference. The more we do that kind of thing, then whether it's people of color, whether it's people who are gay or trans, have a different religion, I feel like all these people who are being persecuted, marginalized, if we step in or we say something or do something, even if we do it as a group, anybody in the subway car does something, if we band together against that kind of thing, then I also feel there's safety in numbers and you can do something without necessarily having to put yourself
in harm. Yeah.
I never advocate for anyone to put themselves in danger. And I grew up, I mean, literally, if you read The Lovely Reckless, like some of the conversations are exactly like the ones I had with my stepdad. I know how to get out of handcuffs and zip ties. You and your girlfriend should go online because you can actually learn how to do zip ties on YouTube.
I was literally just thinking you should do a video on teaching people how to escape from them.
I'm much older than you. I'm almost 45. There were these girls kidnapped in the 70s in Maryland. My stepdad was always, what do you do if someone grabs you? He wanted to make sure that if I was in a certain
situation, you could properly defend yourself.
Or I knew what to do, what right. choice to make. For example, this is my opinion. You know, I'm not a law enforcement agent, so I don't advocate that anyone follow my advice unless they think it's good. But he always taught me, you generally, if someone is going to sexually assault you, it happens wherever you are. But when people relocate you, put you in a car and take you to a secondary location, it's probably because you're not coming back. So the rule of thumb is if you're worried about fighting back and you're not sure or you're not comfortable, the time that you definitely fight back is if someone's trying to take you somewhere. My friend's mom, she opened a car door on the freeway in LA and threw herself out of a car.
What?
Yeah, this guy grabbed her. And she broke her shoulder and her arm, and she was perfectly fine. I mean, a moving car, not get slowed down. She'd taken enough self-defense. She knew that the likelihood of wherever he was taking her, if he just wanted to carjack her, he would just take her car and leave her there.
Yes.
But he took her with him. He had this, I ended up doing a lot of creepy serial killer research for the X-Files book. And then, so now I know even more stuff I didn't need to know. But I feel like at the same time, I would rather know. I feel like because he drilled that stuff into us, I was in a situation, I used to make fun of him all the time. All my friends think you're totally creepy. I used to totally make fun of him. In my early 20s, I ended up needing to use the things he taught me seriously.
Was it in college?
It was right out of college. I lived in Silver Spring in Maryland, and I was teaching right on the Maryland, D.C. line. I was living by myself in an apartment, but it was like the year after I graduated from college. The thing about that kind of conditioning is it's very much like being in the military. When you're in a scary situation, it kicks in. And it becomes second nature. You don't think about it. You just do it. And I understand now why the military, why they do drills like over and over and over again. And it's so that when those guys are in a firefight or whatever, they know exactly what to do. I remember in my mind, I was ticking through the list of the steps of what do I do to get out of a situation. If he hadn't drilled me for so long growing up, I would have just panicked and I wouldn't have been able to think straight.
Was this a situation that was like a kidnapping or a rape?
I woke up and there was a guy I didn't know in my room.
What? He broke in?
I'm almost 100% sure. I was sick and I used to wait tables in Georgetown. And I think I might've been in college still. I was like 22. And I came home that night and I remember I had taken NyQuil and I was really sick. And I think on like the fact that there was no breaking and entering, I'm pretty sure I left my door unlocked accidentally. I think he just walked in.
So you woke up. You saw this figure, this man standing in front of you. Was it nighttime? Was it daytime?
I woke up. It was like 9:30 in the morning and it was light outside. And there was a guy next to my bed and he was kneeling next to my bed. I have really vivid dreams. And so I remember thinking, whatever, there's no one there. And I closed my eyes and then I opened up one eye and he was still there. I could only see one of his hands. His other arm was positioned next to him, but below my line of vision. So I had no way of knowing if he was armed, which is the most important thing to know in that situation. I was trying to figure that out. And then it seemed like the fact that I woke up really suddenly flustered him and he jumped up. And then when I saw he had nothing in his hands, I knew I had a shot. Is he armed? No. The next thing, the guy jumped up on my bed. You have to make yourself as big as you can be.
I see like more alpha.
Yeah, or crazy. You can't play crazy when you just wake up and you've taken cold medicine. I mean, even though I kind of am, it's like dog psychology. You have to be super aggressive. You're not afraid. It was like yelling and cursing and acting super aggressive. The minute he ran out of my room, first thing I did, I jumped off my bed and I actually followed him because I didn't want him to get in my kitchen and become armed. The first thing I did was pick up the phone and dial 911. And I didn't even put it to my ear because I know even if you don't say anything, if they hear that something is going on, they don't hang up. And if you don't answer and they hear stuff is happening, they'll send somebody. The other thing is, even if you think you're getting kidnapped, you call 911 and throw the phone under your bed. I knew if I had the phone, I might be able to talk to the person, but even if I couldn't, if I was talking or yelling at him, they would hear me and they would send somebody. And then the next thing I was thinking was, okay, he just like ran out of my room. And then the next room is my kitchen. It was like one of those apartments where it's one big living dining room and then a little small galley kitchen and then the bathroom and the bedroom. Basically, He didn't go in the kitchen. He ran into the living room and he was standing in front of my couch. And I stood at the entry point to the galley kitchen. The kitchen was behind me. If he came too close to me, the guy
was
the
one who
was the block, not him.
Yes.
A lot of people are like, you should have pulled a knife. And I'm like, no. Oh, because I don't know if he's high. I don't know if I become that aggressive. What if I scare him into doing something he wouldn't have done normally?
In that situation, when you're facing each other and he's in the corner, back to a corner, were you telling him to get out of the house? Do you remember the dialogue?
At that point, I was trying to assess the situation. Number one, he had on dress socks, boxer shorts, and a dress shirt and no pants. And that's weird. And he had like a dress shirt off with a pen and stuff. And he didn't leave, which was weird. At that point, I actually thought he was high, or I was worried about if maybe he could have been delusional and like not known where he was. You know what I mean? Yeah. I wasn't sure if something else was going on. I do know people, there's things like schizophrenia that if you have like an episode, you can become disoriented and not know where you are or what's happening. My first guess was that he was high. I looked around and I could tell my windows weren't broken. My door wasn't broken. So that's when I pretty much knew that I had left it open. I asked him, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm sorry. All the doors look alike. All the buildings look the same, which was true because I lived in garden apartments. And he said, I was trying to find my friend's apartment and I couldn't find it. And then I came in here by accident. So, of course, my thought is, well, you should have left. So yes. If he didn't leave, well, I was thinking, you know, he's probably high or he doesn't know where he is. And then he said he got separated from his commander at the Ramada Inn. I assume he meant in the military. And someone who is in their boxer shorts and a dress shirt and no pants is probably not in the military. And most commanders in the military don't live at the Ramada Inn.
Right? That's all.
So
what the hell?
I told him that I would call the Ramada Inn to find his commander. And I had already dialed 911. So I just picked up the phone. And the 911 operator was already, you know, is there an intruder in your house? And I was like, yes. Not like the movies. You don't have to tell them things. Like, they'll ask you questions. You can literally answer yes or no.
Gotcha.
They're really good. They said, is he armed? I was like, ah, oh, it's unclear. You know, she's like, is he right there? And I was like, yes. She's like, don't hang up the phone. I was like, no, not a problem. We're going through all this stuff. You know, I pretended to dial the phone. He thinks I'm talking through Ramada Inn. Then I told him they were looking for his commander. So then he seemed super pleased. He just stayed there, like in his boxers. And she was like, you know, the SWAT team is going to come. And I was like, okay. And,
but how does she know your address if you didn't tell? Are they able to locate you right away?
ID.
Oh,
ID.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Caller ID. It's actually, that's one of the only reasons I have a landline in my house. They can trace a cell phone, but it is easier for them to trace a landline.
I didn't know that. See, that's really good to be aware of.
Today, they can still trace a cell phone, but a landline is easier.
Yes,
and
it's faster,
for a cell
I'm sure.
phone, if you're not the FBI, they might know you're in this building, in this complex, but they might not know what apartment you're in. You know what I'm saying? They sent the person, well, the guys, there were several of them. It was probably only 5 minutes, but like when he's staring at you for
Shit, that feels like an hour.
Long time. And then the SWAT team burst in and it's fine at the same time. And it turned out he wasn't high and he didn't have any issues with his mental faculties.
What
so we're 100% sure what he was doing in there. He's a really good actor, apparently. Like I said, that's again why you can never let your guard down. I think one of the things as women, we're conditioned at a very young age because of the way the patriarchal culture, we don't want to be perceived as hysterical or weak or dramatic. In a lot of situations, I feel like women have a great instinct and feel something is amiss or wrong, but they don't always act immediately or cause a scene or do what needs to be done to get out of a situation because they've been so conditioned. What if you start yelling and screaming and cause a fuss and then it's nothing? Hysterical loser girl who caused drama at the mall. And so that's one reason why I always thought whenever I talk to teens, I just say it doesn't matter if you embarrass yourself, if you prevent yourself or someone else from getting hurt or the possibility that that could happen, you can just play it off later and pretend like you were joking. At the time, if you have a bad feeling about something,
you need to trust it.
There's a very short period of time where you can act and get out of a situation. And if you don't want to be thinking about later how you wish you had yelled, I'm one of those people, if I leave the grocery store at night and I'm in the parking lot and someone's out there in the parking lot and I get a weird feeling and there's no one else around, I go back in the store.
Oh yeah, I'm the same way.
They worry that it's stupid or they're going to look stupid or why are they doing that? And those are the people who get hurt. But I feel like our society conditions us about what is perceived as strong and
or acceptable.
Right. And so it's you don't want to embarrass yourself. think that's one of the reasons why I'm very comfortable with YA. Most teens are very direct. They're authentic. They tell you what they think. If they don't like something, they say it. Most of them are not great at faking it all the time. Yeah. They can fake it to survive high school, but in general, they're pretty straightforward compared to adults. And for me, I prefer that. It's hard as an adult to navigate the levels of BS that goes on with adults. And I feel like that's one of the things that I grapple with in all of my books, even if they are fantasy, is kind of the idea of how do you embrace the person you are and how can you be different but still fit in? When we did Beautiful Creatures, I got a lot of mail from gay boys, which didn't necessarily surprise me. But what surprised me was that the character that they related to in the book was actually Lena, who is the girl who is a supernatural who's ostracized at school. They said that they understood the way she felt because they wanted to be able to be who they really were, but they also wanted to have friends. They were like, I don't want to just be able to be myself and not get beat up. I want to be able to be myself and then just have friends and have like a normal high school experience. Not I am gay, people find out, and then they don't beat me up, but no one sits with me at lunch. That is something that is very relevant for teens, no matter what the thing is about you that's different, because we all have a thing.
Yeah.
But it's also something that adults who read YA relate to, because I don't think we outgrow it. I have to navigate, you know, I'm really weird. I do cosplay. I do all these things the average woman who's not a writer doesn't do, but I still want to fit in with the moms at PTA, but I don't do a lot of the same things they do. So it's like that idea of wanting to be accepted, but still be able to embrace the person you are and not have to fake it, except for really self-actualized people out there. I think a lot of us, I do for sure, grapple with that balance of being true to yourself and having that kind of courage. Most of the teens I meet, they have so much more courage than I do. They talk about their coming out at a young age. They're speaking out politically about things, even if they're not. They're speaking out against their school or injustices. I wasn't that ballsy. They're sticking up for people in a very vocal way that could cause them social ramifications. That's one reason why I really love the YA community, because when they see something that's wrong happening, they're really, really quick to want to jump in and help. Not everyone knows how. All you need is Alex London and Meg or somebody to start the petition and send it to you and give you the instructions. Yeah. And then you have a way to help. And I think that's the thing that I really respect the most about the community, is just that willingness to jump in and do whatever you can for other people that you don't know. And it's not just teens. But again, I feel the willingness for people. I've seen so many different people do it. Victoria Aveyard constantly taking
Victoria, yes.
And like, and Marie does it too. I just feel like the willingness to stand up for other people and speak out when something is wrong is very prevalent in the YA community. That makes me feel comfortable. We've had panels at Y'all Fest and Y'all West, we call them basket case panels, where those of us with everything from mental illnesses to ADHD to bulimia to other physical issues, like we get up there about it. The first one that we did panel, I think, was called Hi, My Name is Blank, I'm a Basket Case. Basically, we got up there and said, like I said,
it's just like taking ownership.
That I'm a number one New York Times bestselling novelist. I'm a triple threat. You know, I have ADHD. I suffer from anxiety and depression. Lauren Oliver was, I've had bulimia. Like, everybody said their thing. I'm bipolar. But the thing that was interesting was that afterward, all these kids came up and said things like, I'm bipolar. I never imagined that I could have this kind of a career. I thought it would always be running my life. Or kids would say to me, like, I have anxiety and ADD, and I can't believe that, like, I can have that and be best-selling novels. Sounds like, well, just so you know, there's 50% of us have ADHD. If you're going to be a writer, it's fine. I feel like there are a lot of communities where that wouldn't be something people would want to participate in. And when we send out the email, literally, we have to pick, like, for the basket case panel, because there's so many people who want to be on it.
Oh my God, everybody, that's amazing.
Like, I'll be on it. At RT Book Lovers, I did one called The New Normal. And it was me and Rochelle Mead and Julie Murphy and Natalie Parker. There was a ton of us. And it was more about, instead of having a diversity panel, it was more about the fact that, oh, Cody Keplinger was like the idea that we are already diverse. Cody said, I'm a blind queer woman living in blah, 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 who writes young adult novels, and that's my normal.
Cody's so awesome. I had lunch with her in New York, and she's one who doesn't take shit from anybody. She's an incredible role model.
Yeah, neither does Julie. And Julie was saying, talking about, I write books where some of my characters are overweight, but the books are not about them being overweight. Because guess what? You can be overweight and actually be happy and have a life. And mm-hmm. your whole life is not about being overweight. To me, the idea that her protagonist, he portrays it that way, that's a new normal. Rather yes. than, like she said, like, I don't write a book where my main character is overweight and that's the whole issue of the book. And I love that, because what she was saying is, what I'm just doing is writing about a different character that just happens to look this way. Danielle Clayton was saying, I'm a co-founder of We Need Diverse Books, but my books are not about being black per se. I just wanted to write a book where the girl was black and she got to kiss a cute boy and go to the dance.
That's a conversation I have too. That I absolutely see. There's Asian Americans too who are like, why does it have to be Asian or black the main part of the conversation? It's not. We just are who we are, and the main conversation is about what it is that we enjoy and what we do, and not about why we are a marginalized group in the first place. So it shouldn't be highlighting that.
Danielle always puts it really well, because she says, unfortunately, we have to still have those conversations mm-hmm. because it's the only way to try to equalize things and yes. create awareness. She's like, yes, like brown skin novelist, that is all part of my identity. That doesn't mean that every single thing I write is going to be about that. It's interesting because she and I both grew up in Maryland, and she grew up not that far from me, but she grew up in a very fancy area. We were talking and comparing notes and laughing, and she said, most people, if they met us, they would assume you had my life and I grew up with yours. And it was really interesting because she was an equestrian. She's like, oh yeah, all I did was like ride horses and I went to private. So I said to her, if whether it's skin color or the way someone talks, the way they dress, that's one of the things that I tackled in Lovely Reckless, because again, I didn't want to write an issue book. I just wanted to write a romance that had some of the things in it that I had to deal with when I was a teen. And one of the things that I dealt was the fact I had a lot of friends who lived in like the projects or not middle-class neighborhoods, white, black, Latino. It wasn't really about race as much as it was about socioeconomics. There were all these assumptions. Their pants like this, or if they look like that, or if they have tattoos, that means they're troublemaker. Or people would make all these assumptions about some of my boyfriends who weren't white, especially my Latino boyfriends. And some of them were from the projects and some of them were trouble, but some of them were for private school. But it didn't matter, because if they had jeans on and a t-shirt and a tattoo, they were perceived exactly the same. When we walked into 7-Eleven, no one was watching me when I was getting stuff. They were all watching them.
This is a conversation that has come up a lot, especially this year, interviews on the podcast. I feel this responsibility that I should be having more of these conversations and creating this platform so that listeners can be aware, especially those who are more so in communities where they don't have access to as much of yeah. these honest conversations.
Right.
Do you mind me asking, what is your ethnicity? Are you fully Caucasian? Are you...
I'm actually white. My married name is Garcia. I am the mother, I say, of half Latino kids. My husband is 100% Cuban. My dad's family a long time ago was from Spain, but that's still European. You know what I mean? It's not considered Latin. But a lot of people assume, because my last name is Garcia, that I'm Latin, but I'm not.
I would love to know your take on writing diverse characters, because there's talk. And I feel yeah. like it's fair to talk to everybody about their opinions, and there needs to be a common ground. So my question to you is, I have listeners who are writing their own characters. There are full-on Caucasian, like, who feel they also want to take the responsibility in creating more of a space for marginalized characters to be seen. For example, one of them might want to write about a transgender character or about a black character. So there are published authors who feel, all right, if you have no relation to that character whatsoever, as long as you make that character more so a secondary character rather than the main character, but doing your full-on research, then that's okay.
Yeah.
Then there's other authors who fall in the line of, no, you need to leave that space for those characters to be written by those who are truly part of the marginalized
right.
group, so that there is a chance for them to represent their own people in the publishing world, because there's not enough of that.
Danielle Clayton and I have actually talked about this. It came up at that panel we were on at RT Book Lovers Convention, and she said for her own voice, This is about your POV character. For her, people were saying, oh, well, I can't write any Black character. She's like, no, what I'm saying is if you aren't Black or you have no Black experience, your POV character should not be Black. That doesn't mean that there can't be other characters. And it was interesting because I said, my POV character is white. But one of her friends is Black. One of her friends is like half Latin and half white. The boy in the story is Latin. But the reason I was very comfortable with that is because I was writing about a neighborhood in an area where my friends were and I hung out and I dated people and I went to dinner.
You have firsthand experience. Yes.
Right. So I felt like I was using the voice of people I knew. I wouldn't write a traditional Chinese character from a traditional Chinese family. One of my best friends is half Black and half Korean. And her mom is totally Korean, like speaks a little English. I could do that. I know what she cooks and I know about the things, her sensitivities and things like that. Even as a secondary character, like I didn't have any knowledge unless I did a ton of research or I was going to do a gay or lesbian character. Like I feel like I would have to talk to a friend mm-hmm. who is gay or yes. transgender and really get it. I do this with technical stuff too, not just diversity. I feel like I would want someone of that background to read it.
Like a sensitivity reader.
Yeah. I hate that term though. I feel like there's a lot of people who are all, especially some people, not writers so much as other people who want to have a moment on the soapbox. It's like they're attacking such ridiculous things that are not even points, or they're twisting people's words and quotes and attacking people, and that takes away from the real argument. This is an actual genuine issue. Mm-hmm. You don't have to manufacture the fact that people are marginalized and underrepresented in literature. Yeah. Cause drama where there is no drama. That just takes away from the real conversation. But to me, I think that I did not grow up in an all-white area. So I think it would be very hard if I'm writing contemporary for all of my characters to be white. I have to write about the experience that I have. But I also, in my new book, the girl is half Latin. I am the mother of two half Latino children. And I feel like I have a right. I have an understanding of that culture. And I actually did pick Cuban because I know that culture. I mean, I haven't dated someone from every single Latino country. Although some people, my friends would say I have. I love myself a cute Latin boy.
Cute booties.
The other interesting thing is, for example, a lot of people assume I'm Latin because I have dark hair and dark eyes. My son looks like me. My daughter is blonde and has blue eyes. My family is not blonde. My husband's mother is a blonde Cuban with blue eyes who looks like she's Irish.
When I went to Spain, there were so many blonde hair, blue-eyed.
My mom's blonde because my dad's family is originally from Spain. My mom's family is from the South. So there's plenty of blondes. But it's interesting. People assume that that immediately came from my side. You meet his mother. She just looks like a blonde, all-American, blue-eyed girl. You would never look at her and think that she was Latin. I have had that experience with a lot of my friends from Puerto Rico and from Cuba, because in the islands, there literally are people who are brown-skinned, people who are fair with blonde hair. There's such a range. And people assume, oh, well, they're not really Cuban. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, parents are Cuban. She's Cuban. People assume if you're Black, you have brown hair. Black people, Black friends with like red hair. But people assume those characteristics. And that's one reason why I felt as my kids were getting older and reading more, I felt there aren't a lot of books where I read about biracial characters that are either Asian and mm-hmm. white or white and Latin. And I was, and if that's what my kids are, why am I not writing any of these characters? And especially when I do have a lot of friends who are biracial that I grew up with and are still my friends. And even within those friends, they don't all have the same experience. Some of them have grappled with issues because of that. Some of them have not. Everyone's different. Yeah. But again, I think that the key is to write either what you know or you have access to, yes. where you can find a person to read that. Because one of the characters in the super hottie in my book is Black. He's the boyfriend of the best friend, but also this friend she grew up with. And he's very Lenny Kravitz. He's basically looked like a boy I would want to date.
I was going to say, yeah.
You know, and I talked to a couple of my friends. I live in D.C. The term African-American is in question here. A lot of my friends prefer to be called Black, which
yes,
is why.
Yes, mine too, that. Yes.
It was interesting because I asked one of my friends, she said, Cammy, how many of your really close friends growing up were Black? And I was like, well, my best friend was in high school and like at least 4 or 5. And she said, okay, well, how many of them did you see their hair blowing in like a light breeze? I totally laughed because I had this part where he has a twist. They were, you know, like blowing in the, not like in a gust of wind, like in a breezy wind. And she's like, nothing would be blowing in the wind. That's not what happens. But it was just so funny because it's not a big thing. It just shows that there are certain things like you don't think about she was like, you know, if I were reading that and you had kept that in there, I would immediately be like, oh my God, come on. Then I would be thinking, I wonder, does she have any black friends? Does she know anyone black? Her hair does not blow in the light breeze. Certainly not twists.
Right.
Even someone like me who has a lot of friends from many different races and ethnicities, the things that we know are at our second nature for us, our experience and our own experience. And I think that's one reason why Dawn was saying, don't make that character the POV character. Because she was saying, like, if you're not a gay woman, you might have a friend who is. To write in that POV, you don't necessarily know. You don't have the same access. For me, my characters, I write in first person. It's very close. If I don't know what it feels like to have the interior thoughts of that kind of a character, how am I going to portray that accurately?
Yeah.
For me, I feel like everybody gets to do what they want. If you do what you want, you also have to be willing to take flack.
Yes.
If you mess up and you don't want to take the time to make sure you're doing the right thing.
You're going to dish it, you better take it.
Right. So for me, I just feel like the key is, for me, is that the only characters I can successfully write that I have nothing in common with seem to be serial killers because of my weird fascination.
And I love that.
But I feel like, again, I have never written a book where literally the whole POV was from the serial killers. For my POV character, I needed to be someone I can access.
Yeah, you're very familiar
with. Where
I know
what their thoughts are like. Even though I have friends that are gay, I have friends that are lesbians, I have friends that are trans, I still don't know what that feels like. I don't know what it feels like to walk into the store, like the 7-Eleven, and have everybody watch me for no reason. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I can articulate as the POV character how Frankie thinks he feels or how much it bothers her to see people doing that to the boy she loves.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it feels like to be that person. I feel like that's where the divide is. Danielle was saying, you know, her book, it's not about a black girl in the projects. She's like, I just wanted to write about a brown skinned girl like me, could go to a private school, be the star of the book where she gets the boy. And she's like, I just wanted that. When I was young, I had to read teen books. All the main character girls who were having romance or whatever were white. So I just wanted to have a book where my characters just were brown skinned. That wasn't what the book was about. And it is respect for that space and letting those people into the publishing world. But it's also, I feel, especially now with what's going on in the world, the responsibility that we have. There are so many people who live in insular communities. They have never met a gay person. They have never met a black person or a Latino person or a biracial person. They see that on television, or they believe the crazy rhetoric they hear about what this kind of person or that kind of person is like. If we keep writing books where every single person, unless we're writing a book about an insular community, if we write a book about New York City and every single person is white, number one, it's inaccurate and ridiculous.
Yeah. It's so freaking ridiculous.
But number two, there are a lot of kids. And I go on these talks in little towns in the South or in Iowa or whatever. That might be their first or their only exposure, their only chance being the head of a gay teenager or someone trans or even exposure to even know what it's like to live in an apartment, a wealthy neighborhood or a poor neighborhood. If we sanitize everything to the point where it's all middle class white, then again, we're not representing America. Just like a fantasy book is a way, like you go to another world. To me, a contemporary book is a way you go to another place. You may never have been to New York City, but if you read Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, I feel like you get a good taste of what it's like running around in New York with the band. Books give us the chance to be other people and go other places.
Yes, and actually have empathy.
Definitely. Like I said, I mean, own voice is a really complicated issue, but I also think that the important thing is that instead of shying away from it or just being like, well, I'm not going to write anyone of color, or I'm not going to write anyone of another religion. There are so many people, Danielle and Ellen O online, you can ask them. They don't attack people because they don't know and they say, hey, I'm white, I'm thinking about doing this. Is that a good idea? They give their opinion and they point you to resources or other writers or bloggers, places that you can get perspectives.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Just creating that conversation, that discussion.
Yeah. Instead of just being like, oh, forget it, I'm not doing it.
Yeah. You don't have to be lazy about it. You can do your due diligence. Yep.
Marie Lu was talking about getting all this mail from people who were Chinese who felt she didn't represent Chinese people properly. And she's like, I am Chinese. She didn't have a right. Why did she have the Chinese character? She didn't know what she was doing. She's like, I am Chinese. Hello.
Mm-hmm. And those are her specific experiences. Yeah.
She's like, again, all Chinese people, we're not all the same.
Yes, there's so many different stories.
She said, I wrote my version of this character with my experiences, and I'm sorry if you don't like that, but that's within, I feel like, my expertise. I know what it's like to be this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And if you want your character to be more traditional, or say a Chinese teen would never do this or that, you can write your own book and have them be that way.
Absolutely. And I think that's also the catch-22, right? Is that the publishing world is what I'm learning from all these conversations also, and reading articles and interviews, is that the publishing world also needs to step up too and really allow these voices to emerge. So there are more different ways of showing how different ethnicities have grown up and the diverse voices. So it's not just Marie Lu showing how she grew up, but there is space to publish another Chinese American person's story. So it's not just all this responsibility on Marie Lu, because she's not here saying this is the only way Asians grew up.
I think in children's in YA, there is a lot of space for that. And I think that because librarians and teachers, they're so much part of the process, that's why they are making more space for these books and trying to recognize them. It's not Hollywood and the Oscars, because we understand as a teacher, when I would read to the kindergartners, those books that I read, that shapes their experience and their perception. So if I want them to feel we live in a diverse world and a diverse culture with different kinds of people, then there have to be books that I can read to them about that, so that they can hear about experiences that are different than theirs. But if there's no picture books about anyone brown skinned or anyone who's Muslim, and I'm not Muslim, how am I going to impart that?
Yeah.
We need diverse books and all of these different organizations and different authors, you know, Jason Reynolds speaking up. Like, I feel like those people are creating an awareness where the publishing industry does want more diverse voices. Even some of the books, you know, being published that don't address race, they're like fantasy books, but they are set in Kenya or just somewhere different with a very different culture. I feel people are saying, oh, they're so rich. There's, and I'm like, well, part of that is because, again, we're not writing about the same place over and over again. I'm super excited to read Renee Adier's new book. It deals with like samurai culture.
You know what's so funny? I was going to bring up Renee earlier when we were talking about doing research and how you feel comfortable writing from a voice character with the voice of a Cuban. And because Renee, her husband is Persian. What astounded me was just knowing that even though she's married to a Persian man and is already immersed in the culture, she's still writing her books. She was talking to her in-laws and just making sure and double checking for reference and almost like fact checking and just really doing her due diligence so that she does honor that culture that it was inspired from. It just shows the respect, even though she's already married, she's already immersed in this culture, she's still going the extra tens and thousands of miles to really just get it down to the T.
You have to, because people, you know, kept saying, oh, beautiful creatures feel so authentic. And I'm like, well, my family's from the South. I grew up with my great-grandmother and my grandmother in the house with us. And Margie's family's from a small town in Utah, which weirdly is very much like the South. We were cheating. Like, we're writing about places and cultures we know. That's why people were like, well, how did you know about this or that? I'm like, because my great grandma put bacon grease in like every vegetable I ever ate. That's how I know. I feel like there's certain things that you don't know about a region, a culture, being, you know, certain religions, if you did not either grow up or have like a direct access to that. So even though you might know a lot from being married to someone, it's still not the same as talking to somebody like she did and saying like, hey, when you were growing up, what was it like at the dinner table? What were the things you got sick of eating? Because I got sick of eating freaking mashed potatoes.
You can pinpoint the smell of it, why you're sick of the smell of mashed potatoes. That's like, that's how true it was to you.
But I'm sure that if you grew up in a Persian household, mashed potatoes is not the thing that you're sick of your mom serving. You're sick of something else that she serves every night. That's why her world feels so rich, because I think when you take the time to do that, you are like
adding so many more layers.
Place is right. The sense of place feels so real. Again, people make assumptions. I'm sure there could be people who don't know she's married to someone Persian, but she doesn't know anything about this culture. My husband, if most people meet him, if they don't know his last name, my husband looks like a really big white. He's not brown skinned. He has like green eyes. He does not look like a typical Cuban guy. He's been in situations where people are, you know, talking smack in Spanish around him. He is like, he was a Spanish teacher. He's completely fluent.
That's like, kind of badass. So he'll just like whip it out and be like, what did you say?
Since I dated so many guys, I don't speak Spanish fluently, but I know that the dirty, inappropriate things to say to ladies. So when I hear those, I'm like, seriously? You never know where someone's from. You never know what their culture is. Like, we have to go the extra mile and we have to be willing to listen. Also, if someone is defensive or upset or worried about someone writing, representing a certain culture or race, to ask, like, why? Because sometimes the why is the most interesting part. Why do they care about this? Why are they making a big deal about it? And people will say that to me and I'm like, you know what? You should ask them. If you did and they told you, I think you wouldn't say, why are they making a big deal about it? Where's the line? And that was why it was a fun panel, because people did ask. They were like, well, where's the line? Like, can it be the best friend? Can it be the boyfriend? I liked hearing people ask all those questions because I felt like that asking questions and the conversation is how things change. Otherwise, everything remains the same. Right now is a scary time in our country. We have people being discriminated against. After teaching the public school system, I think discrimination has been alive and well this whole time.
Now we have more of the technology and the phones to capture proof of it actually happening.
And we have crazy troll people online saying totally insane stuff. Teaching is very eye-opening. I mean, I taught in a public school and I taught in a private school. It's very different. The kids weren't so different as just seeing the way the system works. It was different. When I taught in a poor school, my kids were awesome. And when I taught in a rich school, my kids were awesome. And they all had similar parent problem. They had different parents, but they all had similar problems.
How do you think, just from experience with the schooling systems and comparing the two, how do you think there could be change made?
Jonathan Cozzal, who is a sociologist who wrote several books about the inequalities in the public school systems, he did long-term studies in Detroit and Chicago and different places. I mean, it starts at the school level. The actual system has to allocate, there has to be a law. They have to allocate resources equally. The biggest problem, we talk about Asian countries and Germany and all these places have such better education and people test so much better. I'm like, yeah, and they also treat their teachers better. They pay them more. They have respect for teachers.
Yes.
They said, we need to hire more teachers. We need to actually pay them as if this is an important profession, not like babysitting.
Do you think something that people listening in can actually do this and actually take steps to help make this change?
The school superintendent makes a lot of decisions and then there's your city councilman, depending on, I'm not sure if it's the mayor or the governor. I want to say it's the mayor. But I know that the most important thing is the superintendent and the council for your school system, because they vote on how resources are allocated and funding. When they have those public school meetings, that's where you go and speak up or sign petitions or find out about how do we get our teachers paid more.
Thank you for that.
I wish I was more political. I mostly have friends. I mean, I am becoming politically knowledgeable about how everything works.
I love that you're sharing this with us because there's so many listeners who are moms and their moms trying to write their stories, or moms who have literary agents and trying to squeeze in time for their writing. So there's a lot of our listeners here who I think would really take a lot from this. So I really appreciate this.
Moms are very powerful.
Oh, hell yes, they are.
Margie and I did not write Beautiful Creatures to be published. We wrote it for 7 teens in my fantasy book club, 2 of whom were Margie's daughters. When I wrote that book, I had a 2-month-old baby and a 2.5-year-old. I had a job. I wrote it at night, literally on my laptop while I was sitting on the floor of my son's bedroom because I needed the crib. So I needed him to sleep in his big boy toddler bed. But every time I put him in his big boy toddler bed, he would run out of his room because he was very excited that he could escape. So I would sit on the floor until he fell asleep. And so instead of being on my phone, I would sit there for an hour or whatever and write on my computer. The one thing is, I feel like a lot of people who want to be writers feel like they need a magic formula or they need all this time. There are a lot of people who, if you write a page a day, at the end of a year, you have a book, at least for YA. Even if you only write 15 minutes a day, you only write on Saturdays, you only write one page a day or one paragraph a day, whatever your dream is, if you want to have a store on Etsy, you were talking about your girlfriend, you want to open a tea shop, whatever it is, you have to take a risk. You
just
can't
do
have
it.
To make
it.
Yeah, you
yeah,
have to
you
make
just
it
do it.
Time.
Yeah.
And even if it takes way longer because you only have an hour a day and somebody else has 12 hours a day, you will still get there. You just have to plug along and not give up.
Yes, you have to plow through.
Think about, J.K. Rowling. She spent years writing them. Well, clearly it was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. Can you imagine if she didn't? Oh my gosh.
When she was sitting in the coffee shop writing the cafe, writing that book, because she couldn't pay her bills and needed to support her daughter. I doubt in many interviews she has said she certainly did not think it was going to be Harry Potter. She did not think it was going to become a phenomenon and she was going to become wealthy and famous. You don't know. You're not going to have a book published or money off of it or have other people read it or have a satisfaction of doing it if you don't start. You have to start and you have to not give up. You have to just keep going, even if it takes a long time.
That's the whole key to this whole game. It's just really about persistence. Cammie, do you mind if I could squeeze in one of your fan questions?
Yeah.
And she loves your work. Since we were talking about Beautiful Creatures, she said that for her own experience, blurring the lines between protagonist and antagonist is never the easiest thing to do. And it's done so well in the Beautiful Creatures series. And so Vanessa Andrew, our listener, would love to know if there's any advice that you have for her and listeners like her on creating believable blurred line characters, especially those involved in a system of magic. And I thought that was quite a beautiful question.
Yeah, it's very well written too. Well, I think the number one is always reading. Reading, and I actually believe a lot in film too, because films come from screenplays. Read books and series where you recognize that.
Yeah.
You know, Lord of the Rings has a lot of that, more so the comic books, but even in the movies, you know, like Magneto from the X-Men is a classic character like that. If you're a human, he's a villain. If you're a mutant, he's a hero. He's trying to save his people. So to me, unless you're writing someone who's like a psychopath, who's like just like murdering people, some sick enjoyment, most quote unquote villains are, they're still regular people and they're the hero of their own story. Darth Vader does not think he has his own agenda and he thinks he's working towards something, even though he later learns perhaps not. You know, J.K. Rowling did it really interestingly. I don't think she blurred the line as much because she obviously, Voldemort is supposed to be evil, but even just showing his past, part of it is about what factors create that character. And even if the character is really hateful and horrible like he is, he came from somewhere. Where did that start? Where did that, you know, anger and all of that hate begin? And then when you want somebody who's more Malfoy than his parents, then you need a character where they are not purely evil. Like there is some good in them. With magic, I always think of it as it's either the wound, something that hurt you that has caused you to take this position, or misinformation. Think about the past. Where did the character come from? And even if you don't put it in the story, if you write your own little short notes or your short story version of their past, I think then you will write things that are informed by that past. But if you just have a black and white villain where they're just terrible all the time just because they really hate the world and they just want to be evil, like there are people like that, but there aren't many. Like most of those people are criminally insane. Listen, I read a lot of the comic books instead of Margie, and comic books do a great job of that. The idea that they show that for a character like Magneto to become like uber human hater, it started with the humans trying to exterminate them.
Cammie, that was so well put. Our listener is going to be so happy with that. I know you also have the X-Files Origins Agent of Chaos. And so what you're in charge of writing was about Mulder. Were you having your own personal obsession over that character?
I am an X-Files fan. And I think that if you're going to write, there's a lot of YA authors that are writing Star Wars novels. Like if you're going to write for a fandom like that, usually the writer is a fan. You have to know the material. And also, for example, mine, everything had to be approved by Chris Carter, the creator of the X-Files show, and by Fox that has the rights. And so you have to jump through a lot of hoops. So I feel like it's very hard to jump through those hoops if you don't know the material, because then you're going to make a lot of mistakes and they're going to be really unhappy. But the key, though, is that I think that as a fan, you want to write the kind of book that you were dying to read as a fan. So my task was to create this origin story for Mulder to fill in the gap. Chris Carter showed in some of the episodes, his sister disappears, which is the ghost in his life, overshadows even his adulthood. But then you don't see a lot of his life again until the show starts and he's in the FBI. There's obviously a big gap. My story is really, it's set in 1979 when he's a senior in high school. And it's set in Washington, D.C. because his dad works for the State Department in the book. Basically, a kid goes missing in D.C. see. And it stirs up all these feelings about his sister disappearing and him not having no resolution, not being able to find her or know what happened to her. And again, it was a situation of reverse engineering. I wanted the character to feel like the Fox Mulder that we know from the show, mm-hmm. but a younger version. I looked at his characteristics and his personality traits. You know, he's loyal, he's obsessive, he's incredibly persistent, sarcastic, stubborn. I looked at all those characteristics and I thought, how are those things amplified as a teen? How would those manifest as a teen? And what are the parts of his personality that were probably forming because of events rather than you're born and you just happen to be very smart? I wanted to play with that a lot, but I really wanted to play with the idea of the more you watch the show and you see his loyalty to Scully and the other people he cares about, his dedication to wanting to find out what happened to his sister and possibly find her was so prominent that I felt at that age, that would be his focus. Like 4.5 years prior, you're in the same room with your sibling and your sibling, you know, the lights go out and your sibling disappears. That's going to rule your life. Jonathan Mayberry, he did the Scully book, which is called The Devil's Advocate. Our mission was basically to write origin stories for our characters, but to also write a YA thriller suspense that you could read if you didn't know who Mulder and Scully were. So it was twofold. It was planting Easter eggs and all these fun things for fans and creating a believable version of Mulder and Scully and explaining why he became a believer and she became a skeptic. But it was also about making sure that we introduced enough about these characters and their backstory, and we had an exciting, relevant plot line that if you don't know about the X-Files and you do not want to go back and watch 9 episodes, you could pick up this book and find out it's about this kid named Fox and read the book, love it, and have a Mr. Vance. Obviously, as much as we love just to write for the X-Files fans, part of it is also wanting to write about a great character and give them a great story and be able to introduce new people to those characters that we love. And can't suck in a new person if they have to do a ton of homework to be able to get invested. When you get to write a character that isn't yours, that you love from TV or books, movies, it's like playing in someone else's sandbox. You're getting to enjoy playing with the character someone else created, but now you get to add your own spin.
That's so true, too. It's such a huge compliment. Congratulations to you. Very exciting. And I'm so happy that you also gave a snapshot of that newest book.
Weirdly, I went from writing mostly fantasy. Now, you know, I have contemporary romance. I have X-Files is definitely more suspense. But again, all of my books have some romance in them.
You don't even have to be in your teen years. Everyone wants romance, no matter how old you are.
One I'm working on right now that hasn't even been announced is also another standalone contemporary romance. A lot of different things. But like I said, the common thread really is that obviously it's YA. And I do, whether it's romance or not, like I still also like a strong plot line because I like to be surprised when I read. Like I love it when I read someone's book and there's something I was not at all anticipating. Love to have like a great surprise.
I like it when authors think more in layers and actually bring something that I never would have thought of, but in a clever way. I think that's one of the hardest things to do as an author too, to weave that in.
It is, but it's what you said. It's about layers. Yeah. It's not there in the first draft, at least not mine. The groundwork is there, but the layering, that's a slow process.
Yeah, that's revisions over and over again.
It's weaving. You have to just keep layering until you have so much that it's part of the fabric of the story.
Cammy, you are so awesome. I would really love if you could share. We have a lot of listeners that do have literary agents already. We also do have a lot of listeners as well who don't have literary agents and have their manuscripts ready or are about to finish their manuscripts. And they're really nervous about querying. I think almost every writer I can say was pretty nervous in that stage when they had to do it. Is there anything that you can advise to them?
Well, they'll mostly hate me because I never wrote a query letter because we weren't trying to publish our book. We were going to put our book up online for free.
They came to you?
My writing partner, Margaret Stoll, one of Margie's closest friends growing up, is a middle grade author, pseudonymous Bosch, who had recently been published. The name of this book is Secret. I think he was writing the second one when we had finished Beautiful Creatures. And he was reading it along with the teens as we were writing it. And we told him our great idea that we were going to put it up on a website for free. And he said, we're idiots not to do that. And he sent it to his agent in New York without telling us. It's a very weird story. But the one thing, having now had 8 different agents and having worked with editors and listened to them on panels, I think that the the most important thing is that don't send something that isn't ready. For sure, if you know you want critique partners and you definitely have someone edit it or basic proofreading for sure in your query letter, you have to check it and check it and check it, because I've read a lot of articles about editors complaining and agents complaining about the laziness of just having simple errors and things in your letter. And I think that, but the other thing that I've heard, Y'all Fest, we had Joe Volpe, Barry Goldblatt, like several different agents.
Oh yeah, Joanna Volpe from New Leaf Literary. Yeah. She's awesome. Yeah.
And you know, and Jody Reamer's my agent, and you know, she talks about Sarah Burns, who was my Beautiful Creatures agent, and Margie's agent who spoke on this panel. And the one thing they did say was that regardless of the query letter, it doesn't matter if the query letter is fantastic if the manuscript is not up to snuff. You get a very short time to suck in the reader. I always feel like people will stop reading the first page, the first five pages, the first 25. I'll read to a page. If the first page is good, you can probably get me to read to five. Mm. If five is good, I'll probably read to 25. But if you get me to 25 or so and it's not good, I'm done. And for sure by 50, I'm totally finished. The key is you have to make sure that the beginning of that manuscript is very, very strong, especially because sometimes you send pages, you're not going to send a full anyways. You might just send a partial. So you got to make sure it's very strong, and I would avoid comparisons to other books. You don't know if the person likes that book or doesn't like that book. And also you don't want to compare yourself to a bad book. So that probably means you're comparing yourself to an amazing book, which means that sets the bar really high. Genre clear. And KM Weiland has an awesome website. She talks a lot about log lines and boiling down your summary, your pitch, the essence of what your book is really about. James Scott Bell, who's amazing, has one crazy amazing books about writing craft. I'm a writing craft book junkie. And then there's the classic, which is Save the Cat, which is a screenwriting book. But the thing that's great about it, and actually Jessica Brody, the YA author, she teaches workshops for Save the Cat.
I think she has a book coming out too soon in like 2018, like her version.
I know, I can't wait. The bottom line is a lot of people, when they're describing what their book is about, they describe plot lines and they leave out character. They don't capture the essence, like the heart of what the book is about. And I think that's one thing that in James Scott Bell's book and in Save the Cat, they focus in on really tightly, is giving you examples from films and stuff and saying, this is not how you would present what the book is. You would say it this way. And it kind of gives you a way to practice it, because you never know. If you go to SCWBI or a place where you get to do those short pitches to agents, you've got to be able to pitch your book. And part of being able to pitch your book is being able to boil it down to really what is a screenwriting movie concept. At the end of the day, whether or not it's you ever want it to be a film or not, screenwriting invented the, you got to give us the short concept really fast. You have to be able to do that. I'm surprised sometimes I'll have people ask me for writing advice, not like my friends, but like people who are that I don't know very well at a conference or something. Ask me about writing advice and I'll say, okay, well, have you read such and such? And they literally have not read the three or four most common writing craft books out there. And I have a Pinterest board that actually has a whole board of my favorite ones. But I'm just thinking to myself, if you want to be a writer, you need to read widely. If I talk about a log line, if you don't know basic terminology about structure and character, if I'm talking about the hero's journey and you know what that is, you need to read some writing craft book, because things like the hero's journey, a character's wound, those things go into characters in every genre to form the basis for a really addictive read. Once you start reading those books and you realize what all those components are, you realize they're in the books you love, because it talks about what makes you love a character so much. You know, really do your homework.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you heard of Wired for Story? Is it Lisa Crone?
That's awesome.
Caroline Lev. I took a class from her in UCLA's.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's fantastic. And she was recommending that along with the 8 Steps, the Anatomy of Breaking Down Scripts. And it's by John Truby. And she loves it.
It's story anatomy or anatomy.
There we go.
Story.
There we go. There
I mean,
we go.
It has numbers in there, but it's something about anatomy.
Yes, yes, yes.
My go-tos are Wired for Story, Save the Cat. I love Blake. I love James Scott Bell's thought and structure. Mm-hmm. And he also has one called Writing from the Middle, which is really interesting, because you know how sometimes you get stuck in the middle? I always say it's like the murky middle. He talks about being able to actually plot from your midpoint, which is why it's called Writing from the Middle. And it's really, really, really interesting.
Oh, thank you for recommending that. I think this is my first time ever hearing this on the show.
Well, I have a whole like board on Pinterest if anyone's actually that interested.
Oh, we'll have it linked up.
I read them all and then my favorites I put on there. But I have books, Save the Cat and James Scott Bell's books. I think I have all of his books. They're like dog-eared and they have
highlights, red marker, everything.
You only need a couple of books like that that you really connect with and help you understand. The other one is The Hero's Journey by Jonathan Vogler.
Definitely. I have that one as well.
Christopher Vogler and Donald Moss also write really great stuff. But I love The Hero's Journey because, again, it just shows you at the core how all these classic films and books that we love, even if they aren't adventures, they still have a hero's journey, even if it's an emotional one.
I love
and
that.
I think that's true about stories.
Cammie, I'm so excited for the listeners to hear this because our listeners love craft books as well. So I think everyone's going to be like, oh my God, gold mine.
Oh my God, so I'm thank such you. Craft book junkie.
No, we are all craft book junkies here. I'm not even kidding. I'm obsessed with hearing what guests love and I love reading what they love so I can learn as well. And as the listeners too, they just can't get enough. So thank you for that. I really appreciate that because the listeners can really take it in and study for themselves and improve their craft. I think that's the whole thing about writers.
Yeah, that's what I feel like.
You just got to have that yearning to want to learn and learn and learn and learn and improve yourself.
James Scott Bell, like that's his Twitter handle. If you tweet to him, if you ask him a question, he will answer you.
What? Oh my God, that's awesome.
Yes.
I mean, I bet he has like tons of followers and it's like, I don't even know how he keeps up. Jeez.
I don't know, but I'm just saying, like, even before I knew him personally, I see him all the time. If you tweet questions to him, he'll send you a link. He'll give you suggestions.
Wow.
He really tries to respond to people. And if his website has a lot of resources and KM Weiland, her website is unreal.
Tons of my listeners talk about KM Weiland in our private Facebook group. And I actually became aware of KM Weiland because of the listeners, because of how much they recommend her as a resource.
If
and
you
how
guys love her, I'm on the NaNoWriMo Writers Board and I did a virtual panel where I interviewed James Scott Bell and KM Weiland on craft and plot and structure. And it's, if you go to NaNoWriMo's thing, they have it in their archive and you can watch it.
I love that. A lot of writers are like artists and a lot of us are like starving artists. We want to create and create and create. But there's also that juggle and that struggle of balancing income. Do you have any advice on tips about earning income while you're trying to do your thing as a writer?
I did not quit my job until we had already written Beautiful Creatures. It had come out and we sold that in a 2-book deal. And we had actually already finished writing Beautiful Dark. So I did not quit my day job until both of those books were done. And those are long books. And honestly, if I hadn't been a teacher, if I had had a job where I could have kept that job longer, I probably would have. But I had a job where you have to be there. And with touring and everything else, it was not practical or fair for me to stay in it. I think especially in this economy, the book industry, everyone is hurting. It's down. People still read, obviously, but advances are not as big as they used to be. It all kind of goes in waves. I think that if you can keep your day job, you should, or at least you can do it part-time or something like that and just like cut it back. Freelance, I think is a great option. You have to have an established career in freelance because I have friends who are really, really well established in freelance and still have trouble making their bills. And again, freelance is like the publishing industry where you're not guaranteed a paycheck. You get paid sporadically. To have a job, whether it's an at-home career or craft, you could be a virtual assistant. If you have any kind of accounting skills, my bookkeeper does accounting from home. She has a whole clientele and she does it on her own time. You want to get published, you want to get published. You want everyone to read your book, you want everyone to read your book. But then when you get a contract and you have deadlines and you have to revise and you have to come up with the second book that people are going to love or, you know, bet more than the first book or hopefully as much as the first book, all of that pressure makes it difficult to write. And having financial pressure on top of that is terrible because financial pressure, every psychologist will tell you, financial pressure is one of the most stressful types of pressure that you can have. You just have to do it and get up earlier every day. I think you have to make sure that you have a steady income or a really big cushion that you put away. I was in a situation when one of my books came out. Our publisher was in the negotiation with Amazon and they were at a standoff in Amazon. They didn't even have a buy link for my book, for any Hachette books. And you don't think about things like that. You don't think about, oh, well, what if the buy links disappear from my books for one of my big retailers? But that is going to affect your launch. That's going to affect your overall sales. And that went on for almost a year.
Oh my God. Cammie, that was some real tips right there. I really appreciate that.
For me, I honestly think I wrote faster when I had another job. I just think that when you have less time and you learn to manage that time well, it becomes precious. And then you don't have time to sit down. If you only have 2 hours a day to write or an hour a day to write, you don't have time to sit down and second guess yourself for an hour. You sit down and work.
You are serving up some realness. Cammie, you've been amazing. Can you please tell the listeners where they can find you? I know you said you have a Pinterest site where you post up everything, and I'm sure, I mean, you're all up on Twitter, Facebook.
Instagram, Twitter, Pinterest. I'm Cammie Garcia. And my Facebook page is my author page. It's Cammie Garcia. My website is just, again, CammieGarcia.com. And then if you go there, it links to all my social. I have Tumblr, but I'm on Twitter and I try to be on Facebook more and Instagram the most. I like pictures. I like to look at everybody else's book pictures of their stuff and their food.
And you know, you're also looking up Pumpkin the raccoon.
I am. I'm looking up tofu and pumpkin, who are not foods, but animals. And I'm looking up food. Oh yeah. I love Instagram, man. You look at everyone's living room, their bookshelf. And I love the, like, everybody's shelfies. I get to see everyone's fancy bookshelves. I'm like, man, my office has like two nice bookshelves, but mostly my books are like, I have stacks everywhere. Big mess.
Thank you for being so incredible. I had the best time.
I hope everyone thinks I'm as credible as you do, because that will be good for me.
And that wraps up our episode with the awesome Cammie Garcia. Cammie, I had such a great time chatting with you. Storytellers, I am so grateful for your support, and thank you for listening in and joining us as always. Please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Cammie at Cammie Garcia. She recommended a massive list of helpful resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up in her show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Cammie Garcia. After hearing from many of you about how you wish you had more help in the kitchen, I am so excited that we're collaborating with Sunbasket. I've been trying to eat healthier over the last year, and it gets a bit tough when it comes to finding the time. I know many of you are like me and don't have all the time in the world to plan out our meals, trek to the farmer's market each time, and figure out all the measurements and portions for each ingredient. And that's why you will love Sunbasket. They deliver delicious, healthy recipes with easy-to-follow directions and pre-measured fresh ingredients straight to your door. And I'm talking about organic, non-GMO ingredients from the best farms and fishermen, and everything is seasonal and sustainably sourced. They have an amazing selection of paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and new family options created by an award-winning chef and are all nutritionist-approved. The recipes are delicious, and you'll literally have each meal prepared in about 30 minutes. Go to sunbasket.com/88cups today and get 3 free meals with your first order. That's sunbasket.com/88cups to get 3 healthy, easy to prepare meals. sunbasket.com/88cups. Don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other writers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we recently added live unboxing and book haul videos. Join me over in our new Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cups. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours, and I can't wait to meet you in there.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.